Hello, my name is Robert Clapperton, and I am the Director of Audience Lab at the Creative School, a faculty of Toronto Metropolitan University. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that Audience Lab is more than just a podcast. We are a multidisciplinary research group focused on tackling challenging questions on how to develop and engage audiences. If you would like to learn more, you can find the link to our website in the description.
Hi, I'm Irene Berkowitz. This is Mediocracy. Usually I host, but this episode we switch it up. My colleague, Dr. Robert Clapperton, the director of Audience Lab, interviews me about my book, which inspired this season of the Audience Lab podcast. The title of my book is Mediocracy: Why Canada Hasn't Made Global TV Hits and How It Can. It's about the fiery collision of Canadian TV policy with the global online era. We go deep on how Canada's TV policy impacts our performance on the global stage, look at other countries who are winning the global battle for attention, and get into my solutions for how policy can help local creators build global audiences. Thanks so much for listening.
Irene Berkowitz is Senior Policy Fellow at the Audience Lab. She is the author of the 2021 book on legacy media, Mediocracy: Why Canada Hasn't Made Global TV Hits and How It Can. She was also the lead researcher of the 2019 report on new media, Watch Time Canada: How YouTube Connects Creators and Consumers. As a researcher, teacher, writer, and speaker, Irene's policy perspectives are requested by publishers from the Globe and Mail to Playback, from CBC to Yahoo Finance, as well as the CRTC and even the Canadian Media Fund. Irene teaches in the MBA program at Ted Rogers School of Management, as well as MA courses at the Creative School. And prior to her media research work, she was an award-winning writer, producer, and TV development executive. Irene, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you for that avalanche of very nice words.
I have to say that I learned so much from your book. I mean, I'm not an expert in television and or in streaming by any stretch, and I was fascinated by your narrative of the development of Canadian broadcasting policy. You know, everything from that point system to simultaneous substitution and how we were able to grow a really vibrant production industry. And it just has not led the number of global hits you'd kind of expect. You know, I look at my Netflix feed and it's increasingly promoting shows from around the world. You know, from Norway, Israel, South Korea, and we as a country do not seem to be keeping up in that global content competition. So I kind of want to start at the beginning. And can we start with what do you mean by, or how do you define mediocrity? And how did our policies get us here?
Wow, that's a great question. And again, thank you for your log line on the book, which is fantastic. When you work so hard on something, you never know if it's going to resonate or people are going to get it. And you really essentialize the book. So mediocrity, luckily, the whole time I was writing it, still got those three dots under it, which meant I had made up the word. I was petrified it would get stolen. Can't really protect one word. So let's play word association. It has a few different word associations. First, obviously, most literally, media plus bureaucracy. Canada's historic policy response to any change is have a hearing. At one point, I ask in the book, is Canada in the TV business or in the TV hearings business? Second of all, mediocrity. So mediocrity is usually the result in many products when you do them by committee. And I'll skip the policy wonk part of my deep value chain analysis in the book that shows how R&D is disconnected from ROI, and just use a quote from a very high level development executive. If you can do an okay show and get renewed, why would you do a great one? You know, financial elements drive creative elements, not vice versa. We're teaming with talent. Why is the result mediocrity so often? Thirdly, meritocracy. Well, we're not. So the book analyzes the challenge of this era, or the goal or opportunity in this era, as globality. So globality is a compound word, combines global and popularity. So if we were to design a system, which I I show us how to do in the last chapter that did that, we would have a policy with a goal of producing global reach and must-see content, and we would incentivize and reward achieving that goal as part of the policy. So that would be a 21st century meritocracy, which we're not. So the three most important things in television are audience, audience, audience. But I also start the book with, yes, how we watch TV has changed, but what we watch has not changed. People want to watch one thing, the same thing they've wanted to watch since hieroglyphics on a cave wall. Good stories, well told. And my whole book is, how do we achieve that?
Fascinating. I love the neologisms, the new words, combining bureaucracy and the idea of putting globalism and popularity together. I think that's fascinating. When I was growing up, we were always worried about being overrun by all these television shows that were pouring across the border every night, and we were sort of becoming Americanized. But that wasn't really the case. And if you could explain the point system, I think that'd be great, because I think that's a fascinating aspect of how the policy kind of came about and what it actually did.
Sure. This will be a bit controversial, but the feeling you got of needing to be protected is a result of actually statements that go back to 1929 in the Aird Commission, which already expressed a love-hate relationship with the U.S., ensconced in 1951 with the Massey Commission, who used that famous invasion metaphor. But more importantly, the system runs on two pillars. One, simultaneous substitution, which delivers the money for the Canadian content. And I call it AmCon for CanCon.
This is the idea of we see Canadian commercials when we're watching American shows?
Yes. There's a long explanation for those policy wonks among us in the book of simultaneous substitution. But to tie this up, the 100-year paradox is that the rhetoric of protection has been used to, you know, purportedly protect Canadians from American content, but the actual regulation depends on Canadians enduring access to and love for Hollywood content. And somehow this all worked for a long time, except for linear broadcasting is sort of over. So the Canadian government has actually known for a long time this model would fail in the global online era. Now, simultaneous substitution had given profitable audiences to Canadian broadcasters. And then the question remained, well, who would produce Canadian content? And they needed to build an industry. And that's where the government and the Producers Association, originally headed up by the dean of RTA, Dean Charles Falzon, worked and collaborated with the government over 4 years to develop a point system that's still in place today that would incentivize the development of a media workforce. And you know what? It worked. It's been amazing. During the 20th century, Canada built a world-class media workforce and infrastructure so enviable and so robust that Netflix chose Canada as the location for its first studio outside the U.S. And that was established in 2015. So we achieved all that, but that era is over. And what my book tries to argue for is now we need a new goal that does no harm. I mean, I'm not a medical doctor, but I do believe in the Hippocratic Oath for policy too. Do no harm to existing strengths. And that's what I've come up with. A way to seize opportunities in the global online era.
So how have the current policies got us to mediocrity?
Well, this is kind of sad, but kind of expected. Even the great business icon Michael Porter has written about the fact that if an entitlement regime or a policy regime is embedded for a long time, the usual stakeholders will protect that regime rather than break out of it. The inclination, the insistence of looking at things in the old way, that, you know, the reversion to if you do what you always did, you'll get what you've always gotten, rather than taking a leap out and working backwards from a new goal. Another thing, the anger at global streaming companies. It's very confounding because back in the day, in 1969 and 70, when simultaneous substitution was invented, there was no anger at CBS, ABC, or NBC or threats to levy them. They use these companies to develop a very unique and very strong way of cross-subsidizing money to the Canadian content system. So my students, I don't know about yours, but my students don't understand the anger at these global companies, which if any time in the recent past is it's more obvious than during the pandemic, that we rely on these companies for everything from what we're doing at the moment, recording on Riverside or Zooming, or for being able to work at home, to yoga, to entertainment through Netflix, to YouTube, how to fix your dishwasher. And by and large, with the demand way up, these companies kept up with it. I think that we could find a way to, like other countries have, which I talk about in the book, many tiny countries have found a way to see this jar as really half full or maybe 90% full. Not saying there's no problems and no unintended consequences of the internet, but in terms of entertainment, it's really kind of much simpler than it is on the information side.
There's a terrific chapter in the book that describes the global success stories in Denmark, Israel, the UK, South Korea. What have they done that we haven't done to create a global audience?
Everybody loves this chapter, I think, because it shows, it doesn't tell. I picked four countries, and there could have been many others because the New York Times had an article about the top 20 foreign series in their countries, from Spain, Brazil, India. But I picked four for their illustrative value and their connection to Canada. The UK, of course, because we're the third largest English market and they're the second after the US. And then I picked Denmark and Israel because they're tiny countries, 6 million and 9 million, respectively. And then I picked Korea because it's only twice as big as Canada, and yet they're dominant. I mean, we know about Parasite and Squid Game. Israel, we know about Fauda, and if you've watched The Girl from Oslo, Baker and the Beauty. Denmark has produced Borgen, one of the few series that claim to have broken the one-inch barrier called subtitles. How do they do it? There's two different plans. I go into the policy approaches of each country, but let's say that in Denmark and in Korea, the policy, and actually the UK, they have had explicit policy goals for globality for a long time. In the case of Korea, since in 1948, one of their sixth president wrote that the only thing that he wants to see in infinite numbers is a powerful culture, and that makes people happy. And they have instituted all kinds of requirements towards that goal. It's a whole idea. You don't have a goal. If you don't know where you're going, anyway, we'll get you there. The UK has had a policy with what they call, quote unquote, conscious intervention towards globality for at least a decade. And they do it on both sides, the distribution side with BritBox and their content side. And although they're only twice our population, they're 20 times our exports. Denmark actually has a policy called One Vision, where they focus on story. All these four countries know that the only way to be globally popular starts in the IP development, in the development part of the value chain, and the development of the story and the strength of the story is directly related to the final exploitation. And that makes sense. It's the same in cars or clothes or pharma. The investors or the financiers invest in the development of IP in order to later exploit that investment. So if there's no pressure at the beginning, then it doesn't turn out as well. My 90-year-old dad, who used to be an aerospace engineer, I was explaining this to him and he said, "Wait, I don't understand. You mean if I designed an engine that didn't fly, I would just keep doing it for the next 40 years?" I'm like, kind of. And then a 12-year-old I told this to said, "I don't understand. You mean that in YouTube, you only get money if you get an audience, but in Canada, you get money just for making a show?" So yeah, it can be dumbed down, but these countries all have very specific approaches. In Korea, you cannot get public funding without proving you have export validation funding. Denmark does not release the budgets of its programs. They only release the audience numbers, and they use the 50% national share as kind of an export test, for a pretest for export. It's quite remarkable that in Canada, the way we evaluate the success of our industry is that we add up all the budgets and see if they've grown. Well, that's like adding up your investment. That's not the usual math. Usually it's done by customers. Audience is the log line of my book. Three most important factors in television that have been left out of our policy regime forever. Audience.
You know, it's fascinating. Part of me wants to just go back and try to say, how could we possibly have taken that industry and turn it into something that's so coddled that it just almost, you know, destroyed the ability to create this great content? And not that we haven't created great content. I think there's a lot of great Canadian shows, but I agree with you. The minute you take away the incentive to make it something that people want to see, it would lose its ability to try and the creative juices that must have to flow to create it. Why you would put all the effort into trying to get the grant. You know, it almost reminds me of, you know, trying to get grants as opposed to trying to start a business or commercialize or something like that. But one of the things I love about your book is it's not just a critique. You know, there's a definite solution side to your argument. And you present a 5-step plan for achieving globality. You know, what does Canada need to do on the policy front to try and escape this situation that we're in?
Well, yeah, thank you so much for this question, because I'm kind of by nature a very positive person. So once I thought, definitively analyzed the problem, financial drives creative. Exactly, no incentive for audience and market trying to move from a supply-driven system to a demand-driven system, national supply to global demand. I thought, I better show people how they can fix it. And I have a strong belief in purpose-driven, evidence-based policy that works backwards from a goal. So I said, solution is going to be in two steps. First, I'm going to show you the critical path, because policy is a collaborative thing. So if the details on this path aren't exactly right, well, we can fix it. But the most important thing we have to agree on is, like, what's the goal? In a way, everything else is details. So my 5-step critical path is the goal, globality. Popular content, global reach. So the next step is, what's the policy purpose? And they're a bit different, because you're getting, you know, more and more down to the ground, coming down from your jet plane view. And therefore, if we agree that that's the goal, then the policy purpose has to be to incentivize globality and financially reward it, because the analysis showed that it's financial that drives the creative. So the levers in the system are wrong. So policy purpose, to incentivize and reward globality. Then we get to strategy, and this is the policy wonk part, which I won't spend too much time on, which is you need to move a value chain from production optimization to content optimization. And that's why I call in the book POM to COM. By the way, a COM model, a content optimization model, doesn't actually in any way harm a production optimization model, because if you look at a very simple value chain of television, it's like anything else. You develop it, you manufacture it, and you exploit it. So the part in the middle where we focused is kind of a standalone, and I go into a lot of analysis about that. And if anything, popular content will increase the salaries, the demand, and the riches of the entire sector. So then that's a strategy. And then the most important, the centerpiece of this whole critical path, is what instrument are you going to use to incentivize it? And I designed something called the G score, with G standing for globality in this case. And that is a very simple 3x2 matrix that shows us how to incentivize and financially reward content, which I designed so it could be used over the top of the existing point system, because we really want to have data and feedback and testing to make sure it's working, if you need to pivot, change it, and make sure it is actually pushing us towards the goal. And then the final, as a researcher, you would know this very well, the final is metrics, which is new measurement techniques. And in that, I said, we got to go from production metrics to audience metrics. Right now, our main reports in the industry are all full of those types of calculations that I mentioned earlier, which is like, how much did we spend? How many people are employed? All kinds of supply metrics. But imagine a new type of reporting where you talked about audience metrics nationally, globally, among various racialized communities, and the growth in audience. And we would see if our content is reaching global audiences. The bottom line is Canada has a total tsunami of amazing creative talent. I mean, our YouTubers are the number one exporters of content on the entire platform in the world. We just need a policy system, and we're so close to it, to incentivize and reward that audience focus.
Is the industry as frustrated with mediocrity as you are? Did you discover that in writing the book?
No. I mean, I did discover that they're not.
Please go on.
Okay. By the way, there's a whole crowd in government and in very senior positions that really get it. But the industry has been kind of, nevertheless, stuck in a backwards facing, like working backwards from a goal is really different than facing backwards towards the past. And not really being able to leap out and seize the future with the type of audacity that I saw and heard about again and again when I was in Silicon Valley, which is supposedly Elon Musk is the type of innovator. And this is a policy innovation, so it's not like inventing the Hyperloop or landing a spaceship on a dime on a boat. But he looks at where an industry will be in 10 years, and then he starts working on something to intersect that curve. And I don't see that type of leap of faith to realize we're so close, we're almost there. We just need to put the pressure on and see what all these other countries are doing, making like an actual tsunami of global hits. Why aren't we there? I do mention Schitt's Creek in the book, and it's Emmy Schwepp. And that isn't an example of why our policy framework is working, because even a broken clock is right twice a day. It's an example of a globality ethos. I mean, we have Eugene Levy, who's been working in the Hollywood system for 30 or 40 years. Sorry, Eugene, I mean only 10 or 20. And a global ethos. Hollywood has always needed a global exploitation to become profitable. And it shows how also, and this is so important to me, that this is Canada's moment, how our cultural values resonate with global audiences. The embedded values in that show really just swept up and made Schitt's Creek a hit all over the world.
So we need to get an entrepreneurial kind of risk embedded into the industry that's not there yet. But Schitt's Creek, did it go through the same process that every other Canadian show goes through in terms of, you know, more of a production emphasis on the funding and less on the content, or was it done differently?
I don't know formally, but there's no way that any showrunner working in Hollywood doesn't have that ethos. For instance, David Shore, the creator of House, said to me, and this is attributed in the book, so I'm not talking out of school. I said, David, what are the first things that you think about when you go in for a pitch? And he's an A-list Hollywood showrunner who grew up in Toronto. And he said, well, what I think about is, are 20 million people going to really love this show? Because if not, I better be really scared. It's right there. Another Canadian Hollywood A-list showrunner said to me, after having a very frustrating experience, but is also managing a big Hollywood show, said the Canadian development system is a warped, broken bridge to nowhere, and I will never work here again. I used to say as a development executive that the pressure's on delivery, not excellence.
Makes a lot of sense. Have you presented your five-step plan to anybody in the policy world? Have you got any feedback on it?
Len St. Aubyn, a former Director General of Industry Canada and a whole bunch of other people at that level, thought the book was fantastic. Yvonne Fetson, and people get it, but when and if this will coalesce into, I'm not saying like the Berkowitz plan as G-Score, but a collaboration towards a goal. I've been invited to Heritage and all kinds of high places. I just think that along the lines of what Michael Porter wrote, he talks about that you get a dry rot and a sort of inertia that cuts competition when you have a long embedded policy paradigm. And it is very, very difficult to get out of that. And that actually government's proper role is not to coddle that, but to really be a disturber and a disruptor.
Do you think it's going to be a case of you're going to have to come up with some sort of hybrid policy that transitions out of being funded for just producing Canadian content to adding extra rewards or something for global hits, like some way to try to drive, you know, at the same time, you're not taking away that the protective feel that that people have when they go to start a Canadian production, but add some sort of incentive. I don't know that if they do create another Schitt's Creek, you know, there's something there. I don't know what it would be, though, but...
Yes. That's why I went about G-Score. I sort of addressed it like a puzzle. I made a list, and I put the list in the book, of six things that this new instrument had to do. And one of them was not harm the existing strengths. And in fact, if audience performance starts to be achieved, it will make, like I said before, it'll make everybody richer. There's been some kind of weird arguments, which kind of makes steam go out my head, that sort of claim that volume builds popularity, but it's the opposite. Popularity builds volume. When you have a hit, you get renewed. Wow, that's economy of scale. Like Downton Abbey didn't have to be pitched 10 times and start over. Like it just renewed. Boy, that saves the entire development, which is all cost. So I have made G-Score that it can be trial tested as a financial bonus over the top of the point system, because yes, I think it's going to have to be incremental and a slow burn. But again, I come back to the goal. Like Alice in Wonderland, you hear that if you don't know where you're going, anywhere will get you there. What's our goal? Where are we going?
Exactly. Did you find anything in your research about the general public? Like I know myself, I didn't know how like 3/4 of the things that you wrote about in the book and didn't actually understand them on that perspective. Do you think the general public, do they have a pride in wanting to create content that, you know, becomes globality?
Yes. Not in technical terms, though, because I actually think that about 98% of even the mid-range people in the industry could not explain simultaneous substitution. They don't care and they shouldn't care. They want to have a job. They want to pay their mortgage. They want to drive a car, send their kids to school. That's how the world works. It's the policy wonks like me that think about this stuff in a back room, and that, you know, is not that many people. If the general public is in any way reflective of A, their viewing habits, yeah, they just want to watch good stuff. And B, if any way reflective of my undergraduate students, and even my graduate students, they don't have any understanding of Canadian content. The new generation, they don't care about it. In fact, I talk about the term Canadian content in my book, and I say its definition was batted around for decades and was never formalized, and it finally got sort of deformalized by default in that point system. But that references paperwork. And I say, like, what happens in paperwork should stay in paperwork. Like, there can be Norwegian TV or Brazilian TV or Israeli TV or Korean TV. Let's just call it Canadian TV and make it rock.
Did you get pushback at all from the industry saying we have produced high global quality content, you know, Beachcombers and with an E, all those kind of things, or did not really? Do most people agree?
Not really. Even from the CEOs of top policy organizations, there have been breakout successes, but they tend to be from producers like John Moranis or Noreen Halpern, who actually really get it and are already working with that ethos. In the book, I have a long story by John about decided to produce something, tried to become a studio and produce something without Canadian content funding. And he ended up making a lot more money because he understands the inhibitive dynamics that are operative.
And when I was reading your book, I thought, imagine if you went with the standard way of getting your production subsidized, but by doing that, you had to give up more of the return, you know, that you could potentially get. And if you, the less you went on the production side, the more return you could keep. Now, I think I've seen models like that where if someone invests in my business and I, you know, you can do all kinds of vehicles for investing in the business, everything, you know, right down to royalties. I guess if you watch Dragon's Den, they're always trying to get a royalty out of it because they're going to get cash flow out of it. So they're basically saying, yeah, I'll give you the money, even though I don't think your business is really potentially, you know, that strong, but I'll take a royalty because then maybe I'll get my money back out before, you know, it happens. So maybe there's a way to build a model that makes it more, there's more of an incentive to, you know, get away from the subsidization in terms of what the returns could be. And maybe that would lead to better content.
You are touching on a really complicated hot button issue, which is IP rights. And I spend a lot of time in the book addressing why they're not in the G score. They're really a red herring. They're not a Gordian knot in the system, which means they're unresolvable. Historically, in this business, in terms of returns, you've always worked for fees. Now, in any business, the person who puts up the money to develop the car or the pill or the season of clothing, they get the profits at the other end, right? So for producers to be talking about IP, and like if you've just created this gigantic hit car, you'll have a pretty good negotiating point for your deal the next time you go in. So there's been a lot of workarounds in the Canadian system about this whole thing of owning IP, and not one of the countries I looked into, and in fact, I've seen studies, a lot of studies on comparative policy regimes, they don't require IP ownership because it is a red herring. What counts is the right to exploit or distribute. So there's workarounds in the Canadian system where like, oh yeah, you can keep your IP, but the people putting up the money are going to have the right to distribute. That's the valuable thing. But isn't it insane that the broadcaster, who actually acts as a studio, and the producer are fighting? This fake red herring around IP is keeping the two main stakeholders from pulling in the same direction. They both want, presumably, a highly successful product. So people ask me, well, where's the IP in the G-score? I'm like, well, it's not relevant to globality. And here's why. So I'd really love to get into a heated discussion with people around this issue, because honestly, it's one of the big stumbling points that is not aligned with the way things work.
So how is IP a red herring? I think I understand it. I think, is it kind of like music publishing, where unless, you know, you may only own the rights to the song, but you don't have the rights to distribute it? Like, is it that kind of an idea?
Yes. Reynolds Masson gave me a nice quote for the book. He's the CEO of the CMPA. Maybe the way they're thinking of IP has more similar to what you just said, which is like, well, I wrote a screenplay, but I own the IP by definition of existing copyright laws. No one can steal my screenplay, but I don't have the right to distribute it globally. And that is what they're arguing about. If someone's going to give me $20 million to make a movie out of my screenplay, you bet they get the IP, but they don't get the copyright. Do Canadian linear broadcasters even want global distribution rights and want to exploit them? I don't know. That's why the G score is also designed to incentivize the formation of studios, which by definition are the entities that invest and then globally exploit. It's very poorly understood in Canada because the linear broadcaster has been like a weird conflation of studio and broadcaster. They make their money from linear broadcast model, which is advertising, and then use the profits on Hollywood hits from the advertising to fund Canadian content. So it's stipulated how much they have to invest, but they don't care about return on that investment because they only have to invest to keep their license to keep broadcasting Hollywood hits. The person who you're partnering with, if you're a producer at the very outset, doesn't really care if you succeed. That's not good. Yeah, it's not good to be in partnership with someone where you're the only one that's mortgaging your house and cares if it's a success. Not good.
So it has to be an adding thing and not a taking away thing. You know, it has to be some policy that adds the entrepreneurial aspect to it, that adds the risk-taking, you know, appetite. And, you know, the policy, and I could see policies like that. Any policy that works like that, where they reward you for taking risks, they, you know, everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. This industry requires that sort of support in order to, you know, take on the diversity issues you talked about and everything else. You could still come up with a policy that adds to that. And I think that's what you say in your book. So I think a lot of people would look at the book and read the subheading and everything and take it as it's, you know, it's basically saying we're too subsidized, too coddled, and we don't have the drive to create great content. But I think what you're saying is we need to support it, you know, because the way the industry is, and just from a pragmatic sense, trying to take away that support is probably a non-starter in most situations. But adding in some sort of incentive to create that entrepreneurial spirit, I think that's doable.
Exactly. Yeah. Content isn't king. Hit content is king. And it's always been that way. And we need to shift our focus from national supply to global demand.
Well, we're not getting any funding for this, so it should be a massive hit.
Yeah. No, that's actually not my point, though.
I'm just teasing. Well, this has been fascinating. I mean, I've learned so much about Canadian television. And it's funny because television is one of those things you think you know about, you know, because you spend so much time watching it. You think you understand it. But this has been very enlightening and loved having you as a guest and looking forward to making many more of these.
Thank you so much. It's been amazing to be with you, and your questions are just so on target, and I have enjoyed every moment of this, and I thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you today. Before we go, I wanted to mention that Audience Lab is more than a podcast. We're a media research group in the Creative School at Toronto Metropolitan University. We tackle challenging questions in media audience research, digital communications, and human-computer interaction. And we've led groundbreaking international collaborations with CBC, CMF, CMPA, Google, Playback, and more. So if you'd like to know more, or if you have comments, questions, or an idea for our next guest, please email me. My address is in the show notes. Mediocracy would not be possible without the work of our brilliant team, producer Sam McNulty, Audience Lab director Robert Clapperton, Dean of the Creative School Charles Falzon, and marketing gurus Raina Latif, Ashley Haraburda, and Tanya Ulrich. Thanks so much for listening. I'm your executive producer and host, Irene Berkowitz, and this has been Mediocracy.